region were extensively redrawn after 1961, but they do seem roughly to fit his estimate of 112,000 excess deaths for 3 years. In the case of Sichuan, as noted above, political pressure under Li Jingzhuan meant that few, if any, counties reported high death rates, and none matched those found in the official documentation published decades later and consulted by Cao Shuqi. None of this is intended as a criticism of Cao Shuqi's work. On the contrary, his painstaking reconstruction of what happened at the county level on the basis of well over 1,000 local gazetteers has established a baseline which is very much in accord with figures derived by demographers from more abstract sets of population statistics. A systematic comparison of these figures with archival data compiled at the time or in the immediate aftermath of the famine would not be possible without his work. And when we confront the official data with archival evidence, we find a pattern of underestimation, sometimes by 30 to 50%, sometimes by as much as a factor of 3 or 4. Perhaps some of the reports exaggerated the death rates, but it is very difficult to see why. There was no political advantage to be gained from declaring extra deaths. The death toll was not a major consideration in the purge of party members after October 1960. The manner of death mattered, as local cadres were classified according to different levels of abuse. In fact, there was every advantage in inflating the overall population. When a team went to investigate the statistics in Hunan in 1964, it found that the overall population was systematically inflated by more than 1%, in some counties by up to 2 or 3%. The difference for 1963 was 500,000 people in Hunan who existed on paper alone. Through thorough testing, we found that in the past the population figures were routinely and severely inflated. When the Ministry of Public Security undertook a more widespread check on population statistics in 1963, it discovered a similar pattern of inflation across the country, sometimes as high as 2.2% in the case of Gansu, for instance. Of a population of 681 million today, we estimate that about 1 to 1.5% of those counted are fake. Many local cadres, in order to obtain greater cloth rations and other goods, intentionally increase the population figures. A year later, during the official 1964 census, the Central Census Office confirmed that the problem of population inflation is far worse than we thought, or at least 1 million was added for Hebei and Henan each, and no fewer than 700,000 for Shandong, three of the provinces that have been closely investigated. There was very little that could be done about the issue. Even if we ignore some of the most glaring disparities between archival data and official figures, the gap is in the order of 50 to 100%. It is very difficult to venture an alternative death toll, all the more since so many of the key sets of archival statistics remain prudently under lock and key, far removed from the eyes of prying historians. But there is enough archival evidence from a sufficiently large diversity of party units to confirm that the figure of 43 to 46 million premature deaths proposed by Chen Yixi, who was a senior member of a large working group that sifted through internal party documents around 1980, is, in all likelihood, a reliable estimate. The death toll thus stands at a minimum of 45 million excess deaths. It could be even worse than that. Some historians speculate that the true figure stands as high as 50 to 60 million people. It is unlikely that we will know the full extent of the disaster until the archives are completely opened. But these are the figures informally discussed by a number of party historians. And these are also, according to Chen Yixi, the figures cited at internal meetings of senior party members under Zhao Ziyang. Yu Siguang, an independent researcher with a great deal of experience, puts the figure at 55 million excess deaths. Epilogue. The turning point came in January 1962, as 7,000 carders arrived from all parts of the country to attend the largest work conference ever held in the vast, modernistic Great Hall of the People in Beijing. Liu Shaoqi, the head of state, issued the official report to a packed audience, speaking for 3 hours without a break, but not without interruption. He did not confront Mao directly, which would have been unthinkable, but he openly repeated everything he had said behind closed doors to a small gathering of senior leaders half a year earlier. In Hunan, he explained, the farmers believed that the difficulties were due 30% to natural calamities and 70% to a man-made disaster. The very use of the term man-made disaster, Zhenhuo, was a bombshell, drawing gasps from the audience. As Liu proceeded to dismiss the expression 9 fingers to 1, Mao's favourite phrase to emphasise achievements over setbacks, the tension became palpable. In general, our successes have been primary, shortcomings and errors are secondary, they occupy a second position. I wonder if we can say that, generally speaking, the ratio of achievements to setbacks is 7 to 3, although each region is different. 1 finger versus 9 fingers does not apply to every place. There are only a small number of regions where mistakes are equal to 1 finger and successes equal to 9 fingers. Mao interrupted Liu, visibly annoyed. It's not a small number of regions at all. For instance, in Hebei, only 20% of regions decrease production, and in Jiangsu, 30% of all regions increase productions year after year. But Liu refused to be intimidated and carried on. In general, we cannot say it is merely 1 finger, but rather 3, and in some places it is even more. For instance, in the Xinjiang region in Henan, or in the Tianshui region in Gansu. And who was responsible for this disaster? Liu squarely placed the blame on the central leadership. Liu did try to appease the chairman by defending the general party line, postponing the verdict over the communes to 5 or maybe even 10 years later. But Mao was furious nonetheless. He talks about natural disasters versus man-made disasters. This kind of talk is a disaster in itself, he confided to his doctor. Lin Biao, the general who had rallied to the defence of the chairman at the Lushan plenum in 1959, again lauded the great leap forward, hailed as an unprecedented accomplishment when compared to any other region of the country's history. He rhapsodised, "The thoughts of Chairman Mao are always correct. Chairman Mao's superiority has many aspects, not just one, and I know from experience that Chairman Mao's most outstanding quality is realism. What he says is much more realistic than what others say. He is always pretty close to the mark. He is never out of touch with reality. I feel very deeply that when in the past our work was done well, it was precisely when we thoroughly implemented and did not interfere with Chairman Mao's thought. Every time Chairman Mao's ideas were not sufficiently respected or suffered interference, there have been problems. That is essentially what the history of our party over the last few decades shows." Zhou Enlai did what he always managed best. He tried to absolve Mao by assuming much of the blame for what had gone wrong, taking personal responsibility for excessive grain procurements, inflated production figures, the draining of grain away from the provinces, and growing exports of food. "This is my mistake," he declared, going on to claim that the shortcomings and errors of the last few years have occurred precisely when we contravened the general line and Chairman Mao's precious instructions. He was trying to build a bridge across the gap that had opened between Mao and Liu, but it was to no avail. We will never know when Mao decided to get rid of Liu, setting in motion a cultural revolution that would destroy the lives of all those who had opposed him during the Great Leap Forward. But a good guess is that he started plotting the elimination of his ever more threatening nemesis as soon as he realized that his entire legacy as well as his standing in history, was at stake. The defining moment may have been a summer afternoon in July 1962, when Mao was floating in his swimming pool. He had been urgently called back to Beijing by Liu, and the chairman was in a foul mood. Liu's son recalls that his father hurriedly approached the chairman, having been summoned to explain what the rush was all about. Liu started by reporting that Chen Yun and Tian Jiaying, two of the most outspoken critics of the Great Leap Forward, wanted formally to present their views about land distribution. Mao soon exploded into a torrent of invective. But Liu would not desist. He spoke in haste. "So many people have died of hunger." Then he blurted out, "History will judge you and me. Even cannibalism will go into the books." Mao went into a towering rage. "The three red banners have been shot down. Now land is being divided up again," he shouted. "What have you done to resist this? What's going to happen after I'm dead?" The two men soon calmed down, and Mao agreed that an economic policy of adjustment should continue. But the chairman was now convinced that he had found his Khrushchev, the servant who had denounced his master Stalin. Liu, he concluded, was obviously the man who would issue a secret speech denouncing all his crimes. Mao was biding his time. But the patient groundwork for launching a cultural revolution that would tear the party and the country apart had already begun. An essay on the sources. The bulk of the sources come from party archives in China, and a few words about these may help the reader better to understand the foundation on which the book rests. In a one-party state, archives do not belong to the public, they belong to the party. They are often housed in a special building on the local party committee premises, which are generally set among lush and lovingly manicured grounds closely guarded by military personnel. Access to the archives is strictly regulated and would have been unthinkable until a decade or so ago, but over the past few years, increasing quantities of documents older than 30 years have become available for consultation to readers with a letter of recommendation. The extent and quality of the material vary from place to place, but in general most collectors distinguish between open or declassified and closed or controlled files, as truly sensitive material remains out of bounds except to the eyes of the most senior party members. The very fact that this distinction removes from the scrutiny of most historians a large proportion of vital information indicates that this book has been written with relatively soft material. Future historians, hopefully, will be able to reveal the true scale of what happened on the basis of fully open archives. Another complication presents itself in the fact that, with the exception of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, most central archives are extremely difficult to access. Most historians tend to rely on provincial and county collections instead. Although a good dozen city and county archives have been used in this work, the majority of the material comes from 10 provincial archives, which were chosen largely on the basis of openness. Until now, no historian, to my knowledge, has been able to work on the Maoist era in the Anhui provincial archives. While the collection in Henan also remains highly restricted, to the point where even if access were granted, it would remain rather meaningless, as only the most banal documents would be handed over to the researcher, often in painfully small quantities. Other collections, by contrast, have been gradually opening up, and my selection represents a good spread of provinces in terms of population density, Shandong versus Gansu, severity of the famine, Sichuan on one extreme, Zhejiang on the other, and geography, from Hebei in the north to Guangdong in the south. The archives inside each provincial collection reflect the structure of the party machinery and are often divided into smaller groups according to the institution they belong to. For instance, the Bureau for Hygiene or the Bureau for Forestry. What the historian finds then is often extremely diverse material, far more so than the stark term archives actually suggests. There are letters written by ordinary people, surveys of working conditions in factories by the All China Federation of Trade Unions, investigations into cases of corruption, Bureau of Public Security reports of theft, murder, arson and assault on granaries, detailed evidence of local cadre abuses compiled by special teams sent in during rectification campaigns, general reports on peasant resistance during the collectivization campaign, secret opinion surveys, and much more. The huge variety of material is nonetheless of official provenance. Even the letters written by ordinary farmers and workers would have been selected for some official purpose, and we have little alternative but to view everyday life through the prism of the state. This observation, of course, is true for all state archives, including those of Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia. It does not mean that we cannot read them against the grain. Finally, any historian worth his salt will know how to assess the authorship of official reports, their intended audience, the institutional context which engendered them, and the conditions of their production. Historians are attuned to the complications which result from the distortions of social reality by official rhetoric, as terms such as sabotage, slacking, treason, enemy of the people, and leftist excesses obscure what happened. Yet the sheer variety and abundance of reports about resistance demonstrate the persistence of rural strategies of survival, while the state itself was a complex, sprawling organization which hardly ever spoke or reported with one voice. Just as senior leaders such as Peng Dehuai and Mao Zedong clashed in their findings about the Great Leap Forward, different individuals, units, and organizations varied enormously in how they reported what they found on the ground. Provincial archives are not only much richer than the smaller collections which can be found in counties, cities, or even villages, but they also tend to keep copies of important files that were sent to them from above, namely Beijing, or from below, for instance when counties reported on important matters such as grain shortages or the collapse of a dam. In the bureaucratic maze of communist China, a document was hardly ever unique, in the sense that copies were made and circulated to many institutions who might have claimed a stake in the case at hand. Many of the reports compiled by work teams, for instance, would have been sent to several dozen party members. An important central document was distributed to every province and county, while more sensitive material might have been copied only to the first secretaries of each province. In other words, a wealth of material which does not necessarily pertain to the region in question can be found in provincial collections, including minutes of speeches and gatherings at the highest level. These minutes can vary considerably, as they were taken by different people, sometimes from tape recordings. Some are more detailed than others. I have tried to make it as easy as possible for the interested reader to find out the provenance of each document. What happened at the highest level, inside the corridors of power in Beijing? So far, to understand court politics under Mao, most historians have relied on official publications, internal documents, Nebu, or Red Guard material released during the Cultural Revolution. In contrast, I prefer to use archival material as far as possible, and I do so for three reasons. First, entire sentences or sections have been omitted from the published speeches of senior leaders, in particular, but not only, in Red Guard material. There are countless examples of small stylistic changes or more profound editorial excisions, and they change the overall sense of many of these speeches. Second, the minutes of entire meetings have been censored, either officially in the mainland or in the Red Guard material smuggled out of China during the Cultural Revolution. And third, while historians have given much weight to meetings on which leading party members have later commented, crucial events and decisions have simply been ignored or censored, even in the otherwise very reliable official biographies of leaders published by party historians with access to the Central Archives in Beijing. This is the case, as we have seen, with the meeting at the Qingtiang Hotel in Shanghai on the 25th of March 1959, at which Mao suggested that a third of all grain should be procured to meet foreign commitments. In short, the entire record of the Maoist era, as reflected in official and internally published sources, is a skillful exercise in obfuscation and, as such, an inadequate basis for historical research. This rather sceptical view is confirmed by a recent biography of Zhou Enlai by Gao Wenqian. Gao, a party historian who worked in the Central Archives in Beijing for many years, smuggled out his notes before absconding to the United States. The premier described in Gao's groundbreaking biography is substantially different from the iconic figure most of us are used to. Gao Wenqian, Zhou Enlai, The Last Perfect Revolutionary, New York, Public Affairs, 2007. However, while bearing these shortcomings in mind, anything published by the Central Documents Research Office, Zhongyang, Wenxian, Yanxiu, Xi, including their voluminous and carefully referenced biographies of leaders, is invaluable. The problem with these publications is the vast amount of crucial information that has been deliberately excluded, and the same can be said of the post-1949 manuscripts of Mao published in a dozen volumes as Mao Zedong, Jiang Gou, Yi Lai, Mao Zedong, Wen Gao. Mao Zedong's manuscripts since the founding of the People's Republic. Beijing, Zhongyang, Wenxian, Zhubanshi, 1987-96. China, like all communist states, has a sprawling bureaucracy in which obsessive attention to the most minute details, even in the midst of widespread want, can reach absurd dimensions. But not every scrap of paper ends up carefully preserved in an archive. Factories, government units, even the courts and the police sometimes dispose of their files, for instance when they move to new quarters. Some of these documents, confessions, reports, directives, permits and certificates of every sort, end up in the delightfully chaotic flea markets of Guangzhou, Shanghai or Beijing. Over many a weekend, as the archives are closed, I have sifted through dusty papers. Some of these were in bundles spread on a blanket, with the owner squatting on a pile of old newspapers. Others were displayed on makeshift tables among memorabilia, postcards, magazines and stamps. I have built up a small collection of documents, as well as a pile of ration coupons of every shade and colour, since they are one of the very few artifacts of bureaucracy to have survived the famine, but have quoted very few of them, and then only when no equivalent exists in the official party archives. A small proportion of the evidence comes from foreign archives, in particular Russian and East German, the two countries that were most closely involved with China at the time. All in all, they are helpful in reconstructing the foreign trade and policy aspects of the era, although they are much more limited when it comes to observations about everyday life. Most advisers were confined to the cities, and by 1960 even the East Germans, who remained sympathetic to the Great Leap Forward for much longer than the other Eastern Europeans, were leaving in droves. A few snippets can be gleaned from reports to London, although overall the fabled sinologists in the British Embassy were pretty clueless, and poorly prepared too, without any apparent knowledge of collectivization and its effects. A low-ranking scribbler with experience of the Soviet Union would have done a better job. Very much the opposite could be said of the staff of the secret services in Taiwan, who compiled extremely detailed and insightful reports about every aspect of the famine for Chiang Kai-shek and a select few of his acolytes in regular intelligence bulletins, which can be found in the Bureau of Investigation in Hsin-Tien on the outskirts of Taipei. The United States refused to believe Chiang Kai-shek, as CIA reports show, no doubt fearing that the Generalissimo might drag them into an invasion of the mainland. However, since the party archives in China are much more reliable, I have not used this material at all. Several times a week, the official press agency Xinhua compiled a report 3 to 10 pages long called Internal Reference, Nebu Zankao, which was distributed to officials at the ministerial level and higher. This source pales in comparison with the archival material, as it was heavily censored, but nonetheless contains interesting snippets of information. Finally, some of the memoirs and personal recollections of party members, interpreters, secretaries and diplomats can be useful, although many suffer from self-censorship and a lack of concrete detail. Pride of place should be given to Mao's personal physician, Li Qixui. Much maligned by some sinologists for being too sensational, he is a very reliable guide whose recollections can be verified, sometimes almost verbatim, in the party archives. An observation also confirmed by Lorenz Luthi, who worked extensively with Soviet documents. See Lorenz M. Luthi, The Sino-Soviet Split, Cold War in the Communist World, Princeton, Princeton University Press, 2008, page 354. I have used a small number of interviews to give a voice occasionally to ordinary people, although, of course, they speak loudly and volubly in many a party document, from opinion surveys to police reports. About 100 interviews were conducted by researchers specifically trained for this project by me over several years, often in the format of what specialists refer to as insider interviewing, meaning that interviewers spoke with people from the same social background in their own dialect, sometimes from the same village or even family, cutting out both the presence of an alien interviewer, foreign or urban Chinese, and a translator. All these interviews have been transcribed and deposited with the University's Service Center for China Studies at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. All the names of the interviewees, as well as those of a very small number of people who may still be alive, have been anonymized. Finally, a short word about secondary sources. While for many decades the best specialists on the Maoist era were to be found in Europe, the United States and Japan, the center of gravity has decidedly moved back to China. A small but growing body of work has been published on the famine by historians who have spent time in very different archival collections. Their publications are not always welcome in China, and more often than not appear in Hong Kong, a city which is rapidly emerging, once again, as the key interface between the mainland and the rest of the world. Yu Siguang is the historian with by far the most experience in teasing out vital information from the archives, as is made clear by his superb anthology, Yu Siguang, Daiuqin, Ku Ritsi, Shang Shuzi, The Great Leap Forward and the Years of Bitterness, a collection of memorials. Hong Kong, Shi Dao, Chao Yui, Chubanshi, 2005. Special mention must be made of Yang Qisheng, a retired journalist who was one of the first to use archival collections from the provinces. Yang Qisheng, Mu Bei, Zhong Guo, Li Shui, Nian Dai, Dazi Huang, Ji Shi. Tombstone, A True History of the Great Famine in China in the 1960s. Hong Kong, Tian Di, Du Shu, Yuxian, Gongxi, 2008. His work remains important, in particular insofar as few other historians have been able to research and publish on the famine in Henan province. But his two volumes do suffer from a number of serious shortcomings. Those familiar with the material will see that the book is more of a compilation of notes from different sources than a carefully constructed text. At times it looks like a hodgepodge, which simply strings together large chunks of text, some lifted from the web, a few from published sources, and others transcribed from archival material. Invaluable documents are thrown together with irrelevant anecdotes, making it difficult for the reader to see the wood for the trees. In some cases, the author spent only a day or two in the archives, missing the most vital and openly available documents. This is the case for the chapter on Guangdong, which relies on a single file for the entire famine. But most of all, there is no timeline. By dispensing with a meaningful historical narrative and focusing heavily on grain shortages, the author misses an important dimension of the disaster. More solid is Lin Yuanhui's magisterial book, essential in tracing the development of the Great Leap Forward. while it relies for the greatest part on published sources and is concerned solely with court politics,